You're listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your hosts, Matt Barnes and Julie
Welcome to episode 9 of the Social Work Me podcast with your host, Matt Barnes. And we have another amazing guest on today's show, and her name is Kathy Steele. And I was supposed to attend a training with Kathy coming up this month. Unfortunately, because of this pandemic that we find ourselves in, that training was canceled. So I thought, hey, why don't I reach out to Kathy and see if she'd come on the show, and maybe we could talk about the training and some of the areas that she was going to be covering. And thankfully, she was kind enough to not only come on the show, but spend over an hour with me talking about a whole host of things. So what we're going to be diving into today is talking about trauma therapy, dissociation, advice and tips for new therapists, and some of the important aspects and parts that emerge in therapy, including working with the inner critic and the wounded child. And for anybody that isn't familiar with Kathy, she has been in private practice for over 35 years. She's a psychotherapist. She's an author, trainer, consultant. She's also the past president of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. Her resume is way too impressive and too lengthy to summarize, but some of the highlights include being the co-creator of the structural dissociation theory, serving on the international task force that developed treatment guidelines for dissociative disorders, as well as being on the joint international task force that has developed treatment guidelines for complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Most recently, she earned the Pierre Janet Writing Award for her latest co-authored book that's called Treating Trauma-Related Dissociation, A Practical Integrative Approach. So needless to say, this episode is just packed full of amazing knowledge, wisdom, and guidance. And if you want to know more about Kathy, you can check out her website. It's Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, -steele.com. As well, if you want to find out more about our show or hear about upcoming episodes, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, just under Social Work Me, and also subscribe to the show if you want to be reminded of any upcoming episodes. And before we get to our interview with Kathy, just a few words from our sponsor, Owl Practice. Are you trying to move away from paper files but having trouble finding an online solution? Owl Practice can help. Owl is an entirely web-based practice management solution that can take you away from paper files for good. You can store all of your client data, session notes, and forms virtually in your account, backed by our secure Canadian servers. All Social Work Me listeners will get their first month free with Owl using the promo code SocialWorkMe. Head over to owlpractice.ca/socialworkme.php for all the details.
This podcast is brought to you by Southwest Counseling Services and Julie Carter Counseling Services.
How does that make you feel?
Don't social work me.
Hi, Kathy.
My video on.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, good. Thanks.
Where are you, Matt?
I'm in Sarnia, Ontario.
Okay.
All right. I'm about 45 minutes away from London, where your training in May was going to be.
Right. Right. Unfortunately, I was really looking forward to that, but okay.
I know. So was I. How's everything that's been going on with the coronavirus impacted your practice?
It hasn't impacted my practice at all, but it has, of course, impacted my trainings, which is about 60% of what I do now. So I'm just sort of working to do some webinars, and I mean, I'm very busy.
Yeah.
But it won't be the same income for sure.
Right. For yeah. Sure. I see you're switching some to being online.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I'm trying to switch as much as I can, but a lot of people who are organizing trainings don't have the capacity to do that. And I don't have the capacity to do that. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
So are you, I saw on your website, you're not taking any new patients.
Right.
So primarily now you're doing training and writing and
conference. Yeah, I have some quite long-term clients I'm seeing. So, yeah.
Nice. Right. And you were traveling all over the place.
I was. It's actually kind of nice not to be doing that right now.
Yeah.
For sure.
A little bit of downtime.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start off? Can you just give us some insight into how you got to where you're at now? I know you've had a long career and kind of been all over the place. So if you can, maybe just catch us up to how you got to where you are now.
Right. Well, it's always a convoluted path, isn't it? I started out actually in college. I mean, this is really the path from the beginning. I was very interested in literature and history and was majoring in that. And then about halfway through college, I got a little bit panicked, like, how am I going to make a living off of that? And so at that time, in my generation, the two things that women were most likely to do was either education, become a teacher, or become a nurse. So I thought nursing was kind of cool. And so I became a nurse and pretty quickly went into a master's degree program and found on my first psychiatric rotation that I loved psychiatry. And this was not private practice work. This was the chronically mentally ill, which at that time were often housed in what we called asylums. So I actually liked that work. And that's what got me started in the mental health field. gradually, I became more interested in the kind of clients that we see in private practice. But I think that time with the chronically mentally ill really has given me a good foundation for understanding the lesser, if we want to call them lesser problems. They're not less, they're just different. And also nursing has really been helpful for me to understand physiology and the intersection between medical problems and mental health problems, which of course are huge. So I feel like those things gave me an interesting, different, but very helpful foundation. And then as I started private practice, two things happened. One was that I joined a practice in which a couple of people were already working with trauma. And so that became something interesting for me because my colleagues were doing it. And the second thing that happened was I, just to get out in the community and get to know people, I joined a group of people who were offering a free one-year incest survivor group. And in order to offer that, it was through a group called the Georgia Council on Child Abuse, and they offered free supervision. So I got supervision and I got a year's experience, and I really, really found that I liked working with that population, even though looking back, I don't think I understood a thimbleful of what I understand now, which doesn't mean I understand everything now for sure. But that's kind of what got me started on this path. And then the third thing that happened, just serendipitously, was one of my first private practice patients turned out to be DID.
Wow.
And I had really thought that she was psychotically depressed because that was the mindset that I came with from the chronically mentally ill, because she was hallucinating and all kinds of things, but severely, severely depressed. But fortunately, I was getting some good supervision from some people who knew something about dissociation, which was kind of a bit different than what we how we understand dissociation now. This was back in the early 80s. But still, I was able to work with this person for quite some years and understand that some other people I was seeing, and even some people I had seen who were labeled as schizophrenic in previous years, were probably more likely dissociative. And it's interesting now because we know that schizophrenia is kind of just a different pathway for many trauma survivors, because schizophrenics have an unusual amount of trauma in their history in general, not in every case, but in general. But they psychosis and dissociation seem to be parallel. Sometimes they run into each other a little bit, but they seem to be different pathways. Yeah, go ahead.
That's a really interesting path. And I'm curious just to hear a bit about what was it like, you know, in the medical, it was definitely a medical model working with the chronically mentally ill. What did dissociation, how was that looked at back then? And what was the
treatment? It wasn't looked at all. It wasn't even considered.
Okay.
There was no treatment, at least where I was, that everything was considered through the lens of psychosis or neurosis, right? I remember one client I had in an outpatient clinic there. Most of my clients were schizophrenic, but this was a woman who was labeled as an old-fashioned hysteric, which we now understand is the language of dissociative disorders, right? But we didn't understand that now. We thought it was more histrionic and, you know, those kinds of things. We had no idea how to treat it, at least not through our models that we use now.
And what were they doing to try and to help these people? I mean, is this the time, like, I guess I kind of think of the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest kind of, you know, frontal lobotomies and just cocktails of medications and things. Like, what did it?
Well, this was sort of past the era of lobotomies, which happened in the 50s and 60s for the most part. But it was right after a big push, at least in the United States, for deinstitutionalization. And so many, many, many of the people I saw in the outpatient clinic, I was working in an inner city hospital that had a huge psychiatry department. And many of my patients were homeless. They were living on the street in dumpsters because they had there was very, very little in the way of resources for them once they were discharged from these institutions. And there is a phenomenon called institutionalization, which means that these clients had become really dependent on others to take care of them, and it had become a way of life through no fault of their own, through being institutionalized for sometimes decades and decades. And so they were put out on the street, and the idea at the time was to build up mental health centers and support systems, but the funding for that in a big way never came through. There were minor things, but yeah, our mental health system has never been able to support those people. And what I know now from working with a few people who are frontline workers and working with the homeless is that many, many people in their populations have dissociative disorders.
Wow, that's really interesting, and I'm sure we've come a long way from back then, and I know at least from my own experience, there still seems to be a lot of confusion between dissociation and psychosis, like you mentioned.
That's right. Well, because there is a lot of overlap in the symptoms, and there's now been a lot written about that beginning in the 1980s. I think Richard Kluft was the first person to write about it, if I'm not mistaken. That there are 11 symptoms that a Dr. Kurt Schneider, who was a German psychiatrist, wrote about, and they were called Schneiderian symptoms after Dr. Schneider. And these 11 symptoms were supposed to be the hallmark of schizophrenia, in addition to the social and occupational decline that you often see with chronic schizophrenics. But it turns out that these symptoms are actually more common in dissociative disorders. For example, hearing voices. And we know now that many, many people hear voices, some of whom are not patients. They're normal people. But within the patient population, patients with PTSD hear voices often, right? And we now understand that as a function of dissociation and kind of split off, if we want to use that term, split off experiences that are reformulated into auditory hallucinations. And we know from dissociative disorders that these voices are actually parts of self that the client hears. And so there are some ways to distinguish between whether a person is psychotic or dissociative. Just the fact that they're hearing voices doesn't tell you anything, but you're looking at the quality of the voices.
Right.
One of the big qualities is can the therapist and the patient engage the voices in dialogue? That is not generally possible in schizophrenics, but in dissociative disorders, it's very possible. These parts seem to have a almost a mind of their own, so to speak.
That's really interesting. And I want to get into terms and kind of the model of the mind with you a little bit.
Right.
Just before we jump into that, I caught an interview you did. It's about 10 years old, but it was an NPR radio interview between yourself and a psychiatrist. And basically the argument from the psychiatrist was dissociative identity disorder should actually be labeled as borderline personality disorder.
Right, right.
What do you, I mean, I guess that's just one example of some of the indiscretion between terminologies and diagnoses.
Right.
But
right.
Can you catch us up to today? Like, what are you seeing now in today's day and age? Do you think there's more of a community that sees that this is, you know, that it is DID? Is there more agreement? Is there more kind of integration between therapists and medical professionals? Or are we still sort of separated?
Well, I would say yes and no, that in many quarters now, there is at least acceptance that dissociative disorders exist. I think there are theoretical differences and there are sociopolitical differences. I'd rather stay with the theoretical differences than the political ones. I think one of the big political or social disagreements is that nobody can have more than one personality. I actually agree with that. I do not think of dissociative parts as people, as having full separate personalities. They are aspects of one person. I'm quite clear on that in my teaching and in the way that I work with my clients. And I think if we can put aside what I think of as a straw man, it's an illogical argument that people have, you know, can be more than one person. I don't disagree with that. But then the question becomes, how do we understand the development of self and the development of personality? Because self and personality are not things. They're mental representations of who we are and how we organize ourselves. Mm. And I think there are many, many pathways to that development.
Well, that's probably a perfect segue into maybe talking about some of the terms and how you see personality and the mind and the self structured and organized.
Right, right. And I think for me, where I start is that all of those terms, the mind, the self, the personality, are just mental representations. They're words that represent who we are and how we organize ourselves. right? For example, I can think of myself, who I am, as quite different from somebody else who might see me differently than I view myself. And we can see this in personality disorders. For example, in a narcissistic patient, they see themselves quite differently than other people see them, right? And so it's not only how we see ourselves, but how others see us. And then developmentally, how children take in their perception of how other people are seeing them, right? Because that's how we develop a sense of self. But so to define the terms is very hard, because I think, for example, defining the term consciousness, what does consciousness mean? Philosophers and scientists are continually debating this. And what is the mind? Is the mind separate from the brain? Is it separate from the body? I think it all depends on how we're thinking about it. And so I think it's quite easy to get caught up in the definitions of these terms, which of course are at least somewhat important, because we have to have a shared understanding, but not to make them too concrete.
Right.
Not to make them too concrete. But our definition of personality in our theoretical work is basically sort of the sum total of our whole experience, what we feel, what we think, what we perceive, what we predict, what our goals are, what our somatic sensations are, our movements, the whole package. And personality is really the way in which we organize that whole package. And personality has to do with our attachment style, how we relate to other people. It has to do with our ability to regulate our impulses and emotions and our thoughts. You know, how well do we over or under regulate? Do we regulate ourselves or depend on others to regulate us? How we do that? How do we think about ourselves? Like, do I think of myself as a decent human being, as a worthy or purposeful person? Do I think of myself? Do I believe that I have agency? All of these thoughts and beliefs and schemas are also going to organize how we behave in the world and how we view ourselves. Likewise, my somatic experience, what is my experience of my body beginning from when I'm a baby? You know, what do I tend to? What do I ignore? What does my posture tell me about how I've been in the world? And also our emotions, what are our default emotions? Do we have a fallback emotion? Like, for example, some people are sort of chronically angry or chronically sad or chronically lonely or chronically ashamed. Those sort of default emotions, our fallback emotions, also shape who we are and how we think of ourselves. So that's how I think of personality.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I hope it makes sense. It makes sense to me. And then we know that children developmentally are born, they're not born with a, I've heard some people talk about the core or the birth personality. We're not born with a fixed self or personality. Those things, those ideas are developmental achievements. They're changing every day. Like, who I am yesterday is not quite who I am now. And who I was before the pandemic is definitely not the same as who I am now. And so we're constantly evolving and changing. And that's what a healthy, adaptive self and personality involve, is the ability to adaptively change. And I think what happens in dissociation is all of these split off little segments have not been able to grow and develop. So, for example, you get a 7-year-old part that is stuck in being 7 years old and has never developed beyond that stage. So you get these little truncated aspects of self that can't seem to go on. Whereas if we have a more integrated sense of self and personality, I can remember myself as seven to some degree, right? And I can think about what it was like to be seven, but I also know I'm not seven anymore, but that is my experience. And that's what's missing in dissociation, is that realization that, oh, that's me. That's me. The woundedness, the playfulness, the sadness, whatever feeling is there in that seven-year-old part actually belongs to me as an adult.
Nice. That's a great way to explain it. And is this, when you're talking to your clients or your patients, and I guess you're sort of long-term patients now, so you would have already gone through this long ago, but is this how you explain parts and dissociation to your clients?
Yeah, it depends on the client, you know, what they're interested in. Some clients are much more interested in understanding. Many dissociative clients are quite phobically avoidant of their parts, and they don't want much information. So I do try to educate them a little bit about that, of course, but it has to be titrated according to what a client can use. I do often talk about ego states, because we all have ego states, and many, many approaches now, for example, internal family systems, EMDR, ego state therapy, all of those use the concept of ego states, which is a normal kind of conglomerate that makes up ourself, our sense of self. And I think dissociative parts are more, are the most extreme end of the continuum of ego states.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think of everybody as having, quote, multiple personality or DID. We're all multiple. I don't think that stands, because we don't all have these dissociative symptom clusters.
Mm-hmm.
But we do all have ego states.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind just breaking down ego states a little bit? Just so
we right. can... Right. Ego states are sort of... I guess we could think of them as the subsystems that create our whole system of self or whole personality. For example, if I think of myself as 7 years old and have particular feelings and thoughts around that, that could form like a seven-year-old ego state. Or I could have, let's say, a teacher ego state, because that involves... for me, kind of state-dependent learning. There are things that I can say in a real flow with you that if I were playing with my grandchildren would be much harder for me to retrieve, right? But I experience myself as the same person, whether I'm a teacher, a grandmother, a mother, a friend, remembering myself as seven. That's all experienced as me, myself, and mine. Or most of it. Of course, we're always working around the edges of integration. Like, we can wake up and say, I don't feel myself.
Mm-hmm. Which
I have done for the last month now, like waking up and going, I'm not myself. That's because I'm developing a new edge, growing edge to deal with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But I don't mean by that, I'm not me really. It's just a saying that we have, or that wasn't like me to be so angry. You know, we say that all the time. But that is really different from waking up and finding out you've been angry and said horrible things to your partner and you don't remember. Right. But it is on a continuum.
Yeah, a lot of mornings I wake up and that teenager part of me is like, no, just
no, stay in bed, man.
And then I guess thankfully we have professional parts and adult parts that help us to stay on track.
That's right. And we can think of those as different states of mind. Some people call them self states. Some people call them ego states, but they are sometimes quite competing and conflicted. You know, like I would rather not get out of bed and deal with the pandemic. Everybody's got some person like that inside, right? Mm-hmm. But we go ahead and do it. But there is this competition between, for example, it's a beautiful day here outside, and there's a part of me that, oh, I just want to go out for a walk somewhere, right? And of course, the adult responsible self overrides, and that's not even an issue. But for example, in dissociative clients, this can be a huge issue, like whether to stay in bed or go to work. Like the conflicts become much, much greater. And the stakes are higher because there's so much separation.
Right. And almost, I guess, at times, no communication between those parts.
Yeah, or very little. One of the things I want to say that I always say in my workshops is that a river runs through it. And by that, I mean that on the surface, parts may seem to have absolutely zero communication in more extreme cases. But underneath, there still is shared knowing. For example, the 7-year-old still eats the food in the present, right? Sometimes even the 7-year-old drives the car. Now, that would not be possible if it were a real 7-year-old. But we have to remember that there are certain substrates underneath that are things that we can pull on to help us do our work with dissociative clients. And this is not at all saying that clients are exaggerating or faking their amnesia. I am not saying that. But I'm saying that the mind has multiple layers in which it's working.
Interesting. I think that's a great way to break it down. And I guess the last term I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about is structural dissociation.
Right.
The model that you co-created, and it would be great to kind of hear just a little bit about that from you before, because I do want to talk about the inner critic.
Right, right. Since our good old favorite critic.
Yeah, so, but if we could just, as we set the stage for everything, just can you touch on structural dissociation?
Sure. Our term there was really meant to take dissociation back to its original definition, because it's been co-opted to mean so many things. Many people now, when they say, oh, my client dissociated or I dissociated, they mean I just spaced out, right? Which is a purely cognitive and attentional kind of problem. That does not equate something like DID. And the original definition of dissociation was really about DID-like phenomenon, a division in the personality, in the sense of self, so that there was more than one part of self. And so we went back to this idea that our personality and self have a structure, they have an organization, and that organization can be dissociated. The kind of organization now becomes dissociative. And that's why we call it structural dissociation, because it's a dissociation within the organizational structure of personality, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And we really believe that, I mean, this is the theory, that the most basic split in sense of self is between parts that are organized around defending against trauma, as in fight, flight, freeze, and faint, and parts that are trying to kind of go on with daily life, mostly around what we call prosocial or relational kinds of experiences and focus and attention on adult capacities. And in a young child, it makes sense that they have to create that split between the child who's being abused and the child who has to go on and make friends and go to school.
Mm. And in social work training, and I'm sure other psychotherapy trainings, we hear a lot about the window of tolerance.
Right.
And it's sort of simplified into hyperarousal, hypoarousal, and hypoarousal being typically where we see dissociation. What Can you talk a little bit?
Sorry, did you say hyper or hypo?
Hypo.
Yeah. Well, this is a thing that I want to challenge a little bit, because there is a lot of literature saying hypoarousal is dissociation. Yes, if we define dissociation as spaciness or shutdown. But if we define dissociation as a division, there can be a division between parts that are incredibly hyper-aroused and parts that are hypo-aroused. I think if we go back to the trauma, what probably happens to the child is that they get overly hyper-aroused, and then there's this deep dive into hypo-arousal, which can also create trance states, as in hypnosis. And I think it is easier then to divide sense of self under trance. So yes, I think the moment of splits can be around hypoarousal, but that's not how I would define dissociation, structural dissociation anyway.
Yeah, and I was curious to hear what is exactly happening in our brains and bodies. I guess the research is only as far as it is, but from a neuroscience perspective, what do we know at this point of what's going on inside during a dissociative episode?
Well, you know, not a neuroscientist, so I can't speak to that directly. What I can say as a simple clinician is that we have ample research that shows that the traumatized brain in general looks quite different from the brain of a person who's not been traumatized, and it functions differently. And that is true for dissociative disorders. And there's been some research looking at PTSD. I'll break the research down into something overly simple, but looking at the brains of PTSD and the brains of people with DID, and their hippocampus function is lower in DID than even in PTSD. And their hippocampal volume, meaning how big the hippocampus is less than even in PTSD. And there's many, many other things around dissociation in the brain. And all of that is taking a moment in time. And so we don't fully understand what all that means.
Right. Yeah, it must be so difficult to research that.
Right. And we do know a lot, for example, about the vagus nerve function in trauma, and whether our detection of safety, danger, or life threat is going to direct our choice. And it's not really a choice, conscious choice. It's a neural choice about whether we're going to feel safe and be able to relate to people, about whether we're going to go into fight flight or whether we're going to shut down and go into that dorsal vagal dive of faint.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, thanks for covering that. And I think that kind of sets a good tone for talking about our friend, the inner critic.
Right. Hello, inner critic. He is all of our friends, I have to say.
And that was really the training that you were going to be doing in London was really focused on the inner critic.
Right.
And so I guess maybe if you're open to it and only share, I guess, what you're willing to, but can we talk a little bit about the inner critic? I just kind of read through the training details, and there was plans to cover natural introjects and dissociative parts and kind of from mild to more sadistic inner criticisms. I don't know where we should start with that, but I would just love to talk to you a bit about that.
Well, maybe I could just ask the audience to have their inner critics listen, right? Because I think in some way, I said earlier in a joking way that our inner critics are, you know, there's the friend of everybody. And I do mean that our inner critics have an important function. It's a backwards function, you know. It reminds me of the metaphor of a parent whose toddler runs into traffic, and the parent grabs the toddler and, you know, shakes him and goes, "Don't you ever do that. You're so stupid." And even maybe could even hit the child, which I don't advocate. But what we know is that the parent is doing that not because they're being abusive, but because they were terrified and they were trying to protect the child. It's not the best way to protect the child, but it's a natural reaction. And this is sort of the state of our inner critic. Our inner critic is meaning to protect us in a not very good way, usually by suppressing us or berating us, but it is meant to jerk us out of traffic because the inner critic thinks we're about to get in trouble. For example, for people who say, "Oh, I'm so stupid, I can't do that," the inner critic is basically saying, "Don't try that, because if you try it, you're going to fail and you're going to hate yourself more, or you're going to be humiliated." And so the inner critic is trying to protect from a predicted catastrophe. Hmm. Now, whether that catastrophe is actually going to happen is a whole nother matter, right? But the inner critic is always predicting what the next step is, and always predicting that the next step is going to end in catastrophe.
Okay.
And I could imagine that for many people now during the pandemic, which threatens our security, our felt sense of being okay in the world, and even economically for many, many therapists, this is now going to be a hardship, because lots of clients have dropped off for telehealth. Lots of clients are no longer going to have their insurance, at least here in the U.S. Clients aren't going to have their jobs. And so maybe we're going to have a drop off in who we're going to see. For me, my workshops have completely dropped off, except for now webinars, because that's what I do mostly for my work. And so we all have this sort of creeping sense of insecurity, like, "Oh my gosh, am I going to be okay? Can I sort this through?" And that is the kind of soup that inner critics love. They feed off of it. And so they start saying no to everything. "Don't try that. Don't do that. That's going to fail. That's not going to work. You're too stupid, you're too lazy, you're too blah, blah, blah." There's lots now on the internet about how we all ought to be being so productive during this time because we're working less. And there's a bit of a backlash now saying, no. Everybody's needing time to sort of adjust, and if you're not productive, it's okay. And I would imagine that many of us have had our inner critics going, you know, "Come on, get out of bed, do something," instead of just sit there.
So,
go ahead.
I was just going to say there's a drive, it sounds like, from the inner critic for us to be better, to be, I guess, the best we can. But for some people, the drive is really for safety or status quo, maybe. Or that's how it comes across.
Yeah, I think all of that could be labeled as safety, because I feel safe if my status quo is okay. If people like me, I feel safe. If people value me, I feel – I mean, it all comes down to safety on a relational, social level. And then if we look at Maslow's hierarchy, you know, at the very bottom, we're looking at physical safety. And so right now, all of those things are threatened. To some degree for all of us. And so our inner critics are wanting us to be better, sometimes even perfect, if we get into more pathology where, well, I don't like that word, but the farther end of the continuum where people expect themselves to be perfect, otherwise they're worthless or they're not okay. That inner critic is really wanting you to be okay by doing everything perfectly. And of course, the bar always gets raised because there is no such thing as perfection, right? The inner critic is always has an insatiable appetite.
Yeah. So I guess we see, you know, this drive for productivity, that's food for the inner critic. Mm-hmm. What do you see as early development, I guess, down to our parents yelling at us running into traffic is a good example. Right. What feeds the inner critic?
Well, I think a bunch of things feed the inner critic, and one, of course, is trauma and neglect. There's no doubt about that, where parents are being abusive. But also when parents are being neglectful, the child has to develop ways to contain and manage needs that aren't being met, emotions. And so they can develop a sort of punitive way of dealing with that, like, I'm bad if I feel sad. And that may not have actually come from the parent, but from the child. Sometimes it comes from the parent. But the child feels a sense of sadness is painful physically, emotionally. And so in the child's mind, something is wrong, and I have to get rid of that thing that's wrong. And that thing that's wrong is me. It's my body. And so in a young child's mind, it's like getting rid of the bad thing.
Interesting. And I have a 2-year-old, and if, you know, my wife and I are sad about something, that's the emotion that she's so quick to want to comfort us and make us happy again. And she's, you know, doing different tricks and things to get us out of that emotion. It must be just so confusing for little kids to see their parents struggling.
Right. And I think for little kids, they struggle themselves, you know, and they're trying to master these emotions and accept emotions that don't feel good and contain them in ways like, as you know, with your 2-year-old, you're helping her now contain her anger a little bit more. My grandchildren are 2 years old, and we're now saying, take a deep breath. And they go, it's really sweet. But, and then you can see kids, really starting to do that on their own. For example, I got a video of my little granddaughter the other day, and she was sitting on her front stoop. And she was doing the deep breath, just kind of sitting there and looking at the world. It was so adorable. But she's now introjected this, internalized this as a way to deal with, you know, just relaxing, learning how to relax. That's how kids do that. But if we don't have a counter to inner critics, they can tend to run amok. And then we believe everything they say without any question.
Right. Well, I want to talk about negative beliefs. But I guess the most polarized inner critics, I guess, that I've seen recently is with athletes. A lot of athletes, I'd say 9 out of 10 of them have an experience of, you know, being in the car ride after a game and just being berated by a parent. And, you know, I think parents love their kids. They want their kids to be the best they can. And that's, I guess, where some of that misguided feedback comes from on that level. And so many athletes' identities tied up with their performance. I am basically what I'm able to put out on the field or on the ice.
But that sense of perfection.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be perfect. Comes from the outside, it also comes from the inside. And negative. That sense of the negative beliefs, right? And they're everywhere. They don't just come from our parents. They come from our own development. Like some clients have a more rigid expectations. Some people have more rigid expectations of themselves than others. And some of that has to do with temperament, not all of it. It certainly comes from society, you know, be best, be thinner, be smarter, be richer, be, you know, more mindful. And so there's no end to the bombardment we're getting about how we should be, and we're never quite living up to that. And we do want an edge of growth. I mean, we do want an edge of being better, but I kind of go back to that, what's called dialectical tension in dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, that says we accept where we are and we want to do better. It's the paradox of holding both of those, I think, that modulates the inner critic. Yes, I would like to do better, and I'm doing my best right now, and that's okay. So that can be a modulator to hold that paradox of, yeah, I want to do different, be different, and I'm okay where I am too.
That's a good point. And when we look at negative beliefs or, excuse me, in EMDR, I guess we may call them negative cognitions.
Right.
In terms of the inner critic, are you finding that oftentimes that negative cognition goes back to the need to be perfect?
I think it goes back to the need to be safe. And if I'm perfect, then I'm safe. I'm safe and loved. And actually, the definition of attachment is not love, but a felt sense of security. I feel secure. In other words, I feel safe. And so for me, it does go back to safety, but that's including feeling loved and valued, accepted by other people. Because I think that is the root of our drive, is to be accepted by other people. And sometimes in people's minds, that means being better than other people. Because if I'm, one of my clients said, I would rather die than be mediocre. It's like, well, okay, but if we're all mediocre in some ways if we look at the whole long continuum. And so she could only be okay if she was top of the game. And of course, we know, going back to your athletes, we know from athletes, they only have a brief, almost momentary window in which they're top of their game. And then somebody else comes along. So that is a very small window of time that people can spend their whole lives trying to achieve. And it's exhausting.
Absolutely. And when you talk about natural introjects, can we dive into that a little bit?
Well, one of the ways we know our minds develop is by sort of taking in representations of ourselves and other people. So I take in introjects, if that's what we want to call them, of my parents, my teachers, the people around me that are important. And then I relate to those representations in my head. Now, we all have these representations. They're called lots of different things. Introjects is one, and that's usually has a connotation of something negative, but you can take in a positive introject. Bowlby, John Bowlby, in attachment theory, called them internal working models, or IWMs. So they're called a lot of things. We can think of them as ego states, like the introject of my mother, for example. And we know that we do best in relationships when our introjects or our mental representations are relatively accurate. And so if, for example, I have a mental representation of other people shaming me or not liking me, I'm going to respond to them not only explicitly but implicitly as though they don't like me and as though I've done something wrong. And then so the internal mental representation gets like overlaid on the actual person. And now I'm relating to you, let's say I'm relating to you as somebody who's criticizing me, right? And so then I'm relating to myself as though I'm being criticized and my inner critic is just going nuts, right?
That's the chunky soup for them.
It's a chunky soup. That's right.
And so you're kind of saying there's two sides of the coin. There's the negative and then there's a positive, like a, and I think of like a, you know, the grandmother kind of figure, like when,
right,
that, what would your grandmother say? Is that sort of in line with what you're saying?
Yeah. And of course we idealize certain people and then we devalue other people. Like you could idealize your grandmother who was relatively, let's take an example, relatively loving, but she knew the abuse was happening and didn't do anything about it. But you demonize your parents like they're monsters. And most parents who abuse their kids are not monsters. They're inept. They're unskilled. They have their own history. A few are monstrous if we talk about sadistic abuse. But that's more extreme. But then I could overvalue the goodness of my grandmother and undervalue any positive contributions my parents made. And I think as people get into therapy, as we grow and develop, we begin to put that together as a whole picture. Like, my grandmother loved me and she didn't protect me enough. You know, I know my dad loved me, but man, he didn't have any skills and he beat the crap out of me. And that really hurt me. So you've got a much more nuanced picture. And we need to have a nuanced picture of ourselves, because we either, in narcissism, we overvalue, we idealize ourselves. And in most cases, we undervalue ourselves. I'm the worst person in the world. I'm the most disgusting. I'm the most unlovable. That's pretty extreme.
Yeah. And when you see people that feel like they're contaminated or they're disgusting, mm-hmm. in terms of kind of conceptualizing their parts, would that funnel back into the inner critic?
It would. And it funnels back into something that I call the most unlikely couple, which is sort of a conjoined twin concept of the inner critic and the wounded bad child, you know, that's not good enough. That those cannot exist without each other. And so they are twinned in some way. And so we cannot treat the wounded child without treating the inner critic and vice versa. Mm-hmm. They need to be treated as a pair.
Right. And then I can kind of think, at least from some of my own cases, that oftentimes there's a sabotaging part in terms of the therapeutic process.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That, I mean, I guess it likely goes back to trust and safety.
It does. And this is what we call in sort of the wider world resistance. And I don't like that term because it implies that the patient is resisting something that's, quote, good for them, as opposed to implying protection. And I think resistance or sabotage is protection. And instead of getting frustrated with a client, we need to understand what they're protecting from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I can think of lots of examples. Like one of a client will say, you know, if I get better, I'm going to lose you, meaning the therapist. Why would I want to get better?
Wow.
You know, or one of my clients said, if I get better, I'll have to divorce my husband. And I went, wait, that's a lot of steps of thinking and I've missed the middle part, right? Yeah. But she went on to explain that not getting better left her in this sort of soup of not really realizing how bad things were. But she also realized that she had no skills to support herself and she was in her late 60s. And so it wasn't likely that she could support herself. And her idea of getting better meant that she had to do something about this marriage, which is not necessarily the case. And so when we were able to work it to say, right, I agree, it's not safe for you to leave. Let's see if we can work on that relationship to make it livable for both of you.
Hmm.
And she really relaxed and then she started moving forward. So the more we understand what the sabotage is about, what the protection is, the more we can help clients.
Wow. I like that. And when you are assessing a client and kind of looking at parts and understanding their personality and their self,
mm-hmm.
In terms of like just from a therapist perspective, are you starting to map these things out? Are you talking openly? I guess it depends on the level of openness with the client and trust at that point. But how does that look in terms of the conversations you're having early days?
Well, I think in my own mind, I'm trying to map out how a person is organized, not only by parts, but for example, what emotions are okay and what aren't to express or to have. Where do I see them freeze or shut down in session or get hyper aroused? In other words, where are their trigger points? I'm trying to map that out. I'm trying to map out where they're willing to go and where they're scared to go or too ashamed to go. I look at fear and shame.
Okay.
And then I really want to look at the resistances. Where do they feel stuck? Because people generally don't come to therapy unless they do feel stuck. And for many clients, it's they just need a little leg up to move forward. For others, these are more significant roadblocks. And they are the therapy, not, I don't think of the goal of, let's say somebody comes in and wants to work on their traumatic memory, and then no matter what you do, you can't get there. I don't think of the traumatic memory as the goal. I think of those roadblocks as the goal of therapy. If we move all those roadblocks, then it's going to be easy for them. But if we try to jump over those roadblocks or ignore them, the therapy is going to bog down.
Okay. In terms of, you know, once you start assessing and seeing, you know, maybe we have somebody with a dissociative disorder, I guess at some point, ideally, we're administering some sort of a test or scale or, you know, the MID or something. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate that? I mean, and any tips for how to do that with clients would be really helpful.
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with tests. That I think they're very useful sometimes. I don't think they're always necessary. And I don't think that they should substitute for a really, really careful, thorough clinical assessment, right? Because I have seen people score something on tests that just doesn't fit with the clinical picture I'm seeing. And so I really want to know, why am I administering this test? That's the first thing. Do I need a definitive diagnosis to put on a chart? Okay. Is somebody requiring a test in order to have a definitive diagnosis? I know often it's hard to diagnose dissociative disorders, and so we like something like the MID or the SCID-D, which really has been the gold standard treatment, but testing, but it costs money to administer it. And it takes a long time. But the other thing I want to think about not only is why do I need to administer it, for what purpose, but also how is the client going to respond to that? I know for many clients who are dissociative, just asking basic questions about dissociation takes them outside the window of tolerance. Because it is touching on the very way that they're protecting themselves from things they feel are intolerable. And so if I were to just plop a 218 item test, which is what the MID is, in front of a client, I really need to know how they're going to respond to that. And sometimes just asking questions about dissociation gives me a pretty good idea of, oh, this person is having a major reaction. They're probably dissociative, but I need to go slower, like within the window of tolerance. So again, I'm not poo-pooing testing at all. Please don't hear that. But I think it's not necessary to give a test to every single person we see. Why do we want to do that? What is the clinical reasoning? And I also want to think about, if I don't have enough clinical information from a client, why might that be? Maybe the client is protecting herself or himself and not wanting to give that information. There's a huge conflict about giving it. And so if you put somebody down with a test, it's easy for them to fake bad or fake good on it. Now, some of these tests have fake bad, fake good scales that you can look at. But still, I think we need to be thoughtful about what we're doing and whether that's going to be within the window of tolerance of a client.
I love that answer. And that's really helpful. And I think some of the trauma therapy modalities that are taught really emphasize doing a scale early on.
Mm-hmm.
I know, especially with the EMDR, you know, doing the DES with everybody.
Right. Well, I think, again, my approach is always one client at a time. What seems appropriate for this client at this time, rather than a one-size-fits-all. And I do understand wanting to know if a client is dissociative before you do EMDR. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But you may just need to take a little more time. And what I really find is that therapists in general are not being trained in how to assess dissociation. And so they don't know the clinical questions to ask. And they don't know what to look for. And so they're just sort of sometimes blindly using an instrument because, unfortunately, nobody's giving them the training they need to assess.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. And I think at one point I probably fell into that category, just, you know, fresh out of completing training, and you want to be taking all the right steps and
sure.
protocols, and you end up with these breaks. And I know one of the things I've learned from working with dissociative clients is the importance of just body language and facial reactions.
That's right. You learn a lot just implicitly, more than sometimes you learn from the actual verbal answers, because a person can be verbally answering and their body is doing all kinds of things, or they've got that 1,000-yard stare, and you have to take that into account.
Yeah.
And also the DES, which is fine. I mean, everybody uses it because it's very easy, but in truth, you can score quite high on the DES and not have a dissociative disorder. You can be just very spacey for all kinds of different reasons and not have what we call structural dissociation. I think more than anything, what the DES is telling us is that the person might have a lower window of tolerance in general. And then we need to figure out how come they have a lower window of tolerance. Is that a dissociative disorder? Is that something else?
Right. Good point. Can you talk a little bit? I've heard you speak about phase-oriented trauma treatment.
Right.
You know, a lot of our listeners will be brand new and just kind of getting into therapy.
Sure.
I would love to talk a little bit more about treatment and phase two work, but can you just outline?
Sure. Phases? Yeah. This comes from phase-oriented work was first described by Pierre Janet, who was a French psychiatrist, psychologist, who has written the most and the earliest on dissociation. There are other people, but he's sort of considered the father of modern-day dissociation. And he came up with these three phases. And then in the 1980s, Judith Herman wrote a book, a really seminal book on trauma, which I would encourage everybody read. It's called, Trauma and Recovery. Is that right? Judith Herman's book? I think Trauma and Recovery. But the idea is that because the kind of trauma we're treating is not acute single incident, but developmental. It happens over the course of development and therefore disrupts the development of a person. It requires a different approach. And so the first approach really is geared toward addressing the developmental problems of the impact of trauma and neglect. For example, developmentally, we should learn to identify, tolerate, and regulate our emotions. Many trauma clients can't do that. And if you try to work with the traumatic memory before they can tolerate emotion, they're going to go outside their window of tolerance. So the first phase is of stabilization and skills building, and also developing safety. For example, if a person is self-harming or very suicidal, we want to reduce that first and get them safe. Or we want to engage in symptom reduction, so we reduce their level of depression to the degree possible, or anxiety. In other words, getting them into the window of tolerance and having some basic life skills. Now, our clients fall along a continuum of less needing that to more needing that. and there is some controversy with some people. There's a segment within the EMDR world now who's saying it is not necessary to stabilize patients with complex PTSD before you do traumatic memory work. To me, that's a one-size-fits-all program that I never have ascribed to. I want to look at my individual client. And many of my clients hardly have the capacity to engage in therapy, much less processing traumatic memory. So for them, this phase-oriented treatment is important. So the first phase, stabilization, symptom reduction, skills building, safety, what I call all the S's. The second phase of treatment can be approaching the traumatic memory, but I think even in phase one, we're working through the obstacles to that. We're working through the resistances and protections against it so that by the time we get to phase two, we have sort of eroded most of the resistances to doing the work. So there's the processing of traumatic memory. Different people call that different things. I don't think telling the story is sufficient because you can tell it in a very depersonalized way. EMDR talks about processing, but basically what I want a client to be able to do is to tell the story without dissociating. It doesn't mean they tell it without any feeling, right? That they make meaning out of what happened to them that's adaptive, that they are not having flashbacks anymore, and that they can move on with daily life and focus more on daily life than on the past. And then phase three is what we call integration or reintegration, depending. I think for some dissociative clients, their self and personality never came together. It wasn't like it was together and then shattered. It like never came together, which is not a reintegration. It's a first time integration. So we're working on getting a person into functioning in daily life much better in a much higher level in phase three.
That's an amazing way to break that down. And I guess this is more of a personal question, but I don't often see you endorsing specific modalities. You don't?
No, because I think that we all have been trained differently. What I focus on more are the general principles of therapy, and that whatever modality you use can be applied. And particularly this principle of every client is different, and do not try a one-size-fits-all. Humanity is much too large for any one modality to hold. Nice. I've had clients that, for example, love EMDR. I've had clients that won't use it, don't find it useful. I'm very much a psychodynamic person. I use that, but it's not for everybody. I use cognitive work, somatic work. I use all kinds of things because I think that trauma affects every arena of life and every aspect of experience, and that we need a big toolbox.
Yeah, I like that, the eclectic approach.
But I want to be clear, it's not just a random application, that I have a set of principles that really organizes what I do. And I think that is what is important for therapists to have.
No, I think that's really good advice. And I want to leave some time to talk a bit about your book and upcoming trainings, as well as some of the questions we had talked about before, but just one more question about treatment.
Yeah, sure.
What markers are you looking for before moving into the phase two work?
That's a good question. Yeah. I'm looking for a couple of things. And first of all, if the client has a dissociative disorder, if they're DID, I'm looking for sufficient inner cooperation to move forward. Do all parts agree that we can move forward? That's the first thing. But in general, what I'm looking for is the ability to regulate everyday emotions to stay relatively grounded, to be able to reground. I want to know that a person has the capacity to talk about something different and stay in the present, what we call dual attention. That's what it's called in the EMDR. People can feel very intense, but if I say, how are you doing this? And I'm okay, I feel present, I'm just really feeling sad right now, which is different from somebody sobbing uncontrollably and unable to respond. Right? I want to know that self-harm and suicidality are in check. I want that person to have a relatively stable therapeutic relationship with me and hopefully with other people so that they've got support to do this work. Can they engage in a kind of reflective functioning? In other words, can they reflect on what's happening to them, or are they just reacting to what's happening to them? Mm. They have to have some reflective capacity so that they can learn something.
Nice.
And staying in the window of tolerance for sure.
Yeah. What a useful term that has become.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's so good talking to you, and I just want to be conscious of the time. So I want to go through kind of my two questions that I like to ask everybody.
Sure.
So the first being, what do you have any tips, wisdom, tricks for new therapists, new trauma therapists?
Oh boy. Yes. A bunch. Actually, first of all, you're doing fine. You don't have to know everything. You can't know everything. Just slow down in session. Take it slower. I have always had a mantra, and it served me well in therapy, is that slower is faster. Because when we're going slower, we can look and see all of the nuances of what's happening. And what is happening in the moment is where the action is. It's not about the traumatic memory, but it is about what's happening in the person as they think about or remember the traumatic memory, or as they talk about their dad or their mom or, you know, being bullied. What's going on right now? That is where the work is. So if we can slow down, if you can take the time to develop a relationship, and I want to say a couple of things about that. Our therapy relationship is tricky because people are in distress. And when people are in distress, we very naturally feel compelled to caretake, to do something. And that natural inclination we have is an evolutionary thing that's built into us that's meant to protect young children. But when it's over-applied to our clients, it can create dependency in the client and burnout in us. So keep your sessions limited to an hour. Don't do more than one or two sessions a week. If you find yourself inundated with emails, phone calls, text, put limits on that. I mean, strict limits to protect yourself, particularly now when we're trying to work at home. We need more boundaries, not fewer. We need more boundaries around protecting our energy, not fewer. And even though our clients might be more needy in the moment, that doesn't mean we have to respond with more. What we want to respond with is quality, you know, in the moment. So I would say those things to new therapists. You will learn the techniques as you go. What's interesting for me after about 40 years in this field is there are very few techniques I use day to day. I have learned the principles underneath the techniques and can use those, but I don't use too many techniques in the moment. Mm. So techniques is almost a way for us to learn how to be with clients.
Nice. That's really important. And I'm glad you brought up burnout because that kind of segues into the next question.
Right.
How have you kept yourself balanced and managed to have such a lengthy career in terms of protecting yourself from burnout and vicarious trauma?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is I haven't always protected myself against it, and I have gotten burned out, and I have had various vicarious traumatization, and I think that is an inevitable part of our work. And if we can see it as these little developmental dips that we go through from time to time, we can learn a couple of things. One is that it probably will happen to you. If it doesn't, you're very lucky. I've found it helpful over time to recognize when it's starting to build up, right? Dread of going to work, feeling like a bit overburdened, like clients are calling me too much, or I don't want to respond to that need or whatever it is. So feeling kind of put upon is a red flag for me. Like, I need to protect myself better. Feeling uninterested in the work, not curious, feeling frustrated or angry with clients who aren't making progress, feeling like I'm not a good therapist. All of those things are signals that I'm headed for burnout. Thinking about my client's trauma, needing to talk about my client's trauma. And I think as young, new therapists, there is a period of time where the trauma is pretty overwhelming. If you've never experienced that, heard those stories, it's going to impact you. One of the tricks I've always had in session with a client as they're talking about the trauma is never visualize the client as a child being hurt. I always stay with the adult client in my office. And that helps me a lot from getting pulled into the story from that perspective. And don't image myself in place of the client having it happen to me. Those are helpful. Watch our imagery.
Wow. I've never heard of that. And that makes so much sense. And, you know, it makes me think when clients are telling stories, I think my mind is naturally piecing together what do those people look like and what's this, the room look like. And
right.
I like that.
And I've really learned to stay with really trying to picture what is happening with the client in the room with me, because that's how the story is now manifesting in some way. Yeah, I do want to get some kind of picture of, you know, some kind of representation of what it might have been like, right? But I have to do that from a bit of a distance.
Wow, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I know in the inner critic training that you were going to be running, there was a blurb in there about managing our own inner critic.
Right, right.
Befriending it, I guess. Is that
well, to have compassion, I think for the fact that we are really critical, and we're often critical of ourselves more when we're under stress, and that's, we suffer. And so to have compassion for our own suffering and our own pain, and then to have compassion for ourselves that maybe we felt it necessary to build up such a large critic in order to move forward. That's the first step in understanding that a critic is trying to be protective, even though in a very backwards kind of way, is another step. And then trying to achieve safety in different ways, recognizing those maladaptive cognitions or negative cognitions and belief systems, where do they come from? Where's the first time I ever thought that about myself? Where did I learn that from?
So I guess this is a plug for doing our own work.
Oh man, if you haven't been in therapy and you're a therapist, do it. Because we all have blind spots. I think we all benefit from being on the other side, on sitting on the sofa, right? I would not myself see a therapist who hadn't done their own work. And I continue to do my own work. So I very much encourage that.
Nice. That's great. Well, let's talk about your latest book, Treating Trauma-Related Dissociation, award-winning book.
Right. published in 2016 or 2017, depending on who you believe.
And I'll put a link for everybody to check out your last book and your website ties in all of your published work and articles and there's so much to read that you've done. So that'll keep us busy for a little while.
Right. And I think a lot of things I've talked about today are actually in that book, including those principles I've been talking about that are so important.
Nice. Yeah. And are you working on anything currently?
I am trying to work on a book on the developmental journey of the therapist, but the pandemic has sort of imposed itself on my own development, so I'm taking longer than I wanted to, but I hope that I will have that book out for people in, I don't know, next year. I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's on my mind.
Well, just cut yourself some slack right now.
I am cutting myself slack. Absolutely.
Tell that inner critic to quiet.
Yeah, that's part of my development right now, is if that book doesn't get written, it's okay. Right.
And so some of your trainings are going to be webinars. I see you do a lot with Dolores Mascara.
Yeah, Dolores and I are actually doing something on April the 26th, which is a Sunday, actually. We just put it out. I'm going to be putting it on my website either today or tomorrow. And it's a 2-hour thing on helping dissociative clients during the pandemic. So it's not a big thing, but
nice.
Yeah. If you go to my website, of course, all of my in-person trainings have been canceled for the foreseeable future. So I'll be doing whatever I'll be doing, I will be putting on my website so you can go there and check and see.
Awesome. And your website, just for the listeners, is
www.kathy-steele.com.
And Steele with an E.
Steele with an E, yeah. And Kathy with a K.
Nice. And that's the best way to reach out to you if anybody has questions or wants to.
Yeah, there's a contact there that goes directly to my email. So you're welcome to email me.
Nice.
I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
So you're taking on therapists for consultation and supervision?
For consultation, yeah. I'm not taking new patients, but I do plenty of consultation. Yeah.
Right on. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking time out of your day to meet with me and just pass on all of your amazing wisdom.
You're most welcome.
This episode is brought to you by Rebel Office, an online resource center for entrepreneurs, including mentorship, strategy building, and graphic and web design services. To get in touch with Rebel Office about elevating your practice, visit rebeloffice.ca and use the promo code SocialWorkMe to be eligible for over 50% off your first session.